Okay, we're coming close to the end of the questions for lesson 25. I think we have one more page after this. Yeah. So we stopped with lesson 24 last time. But let's go ahead and read the text again so that we have a good understanding of what we're talking about when it asks what happened at the sixth hour. I guess we could start in verse 45, Matthew 27. All right, so if we could read Matthew 27, 45 through 56. Jenny, you want to do that?
Now from the sixth hour there was darkness over all the land until the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani, that is, my God, why have you forsaken me? And some of the bystanders, hearing it, said, this man is calling Elijah. And one of them at once ran and took a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a reed, and gave it to him to drink. But the other said, wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to save him. And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice, and yielded up his spirit. And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And the earth shook, and the rocks were split. The tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. When the centurion and those who were with him, keeping watch over Jesus, saw the earthquake and what took place, they were filled with awe and said, truly, this was the Son of God. There were also many women there, looking on from a distance, who had followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering to him, among whom were Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee.
Okay. All right, and then Mark chapter 15. And Mark 15. Down toward 24. Let's see. Verse 33. Yeah. Verse 33 through verse 41. Lynn, do you want to read that?
And when the sixth hour was come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which is, being interpreted, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And some of them that stood by, when they heard it, said, behold, he called for Elijah. And one ran, and filling a sponge full of vinegar, put it on a reed, and gave him to drink, saying, let us see whether Elijah cometh to take him down. And Jesus uttered a loud voice, and gave up the ghost. And the veil of the temple was rent in two from the top to the bottom. And when the centurion, who stood by over against him, saw that he so gave up the ghost, he said, truly, this man was the Son of God. And there were also women beholding from afar, among whom were Mary Magdalene, and Mary the mother of James the Less, and Joseph, and Salome, who, when he was in Galilee, followed him and ministered unto him, and many other women that came up with him unto Jerusalem.
Okay. And over to Luke, the 23rd chapter. Starting in verse 44, Luke 23, verse 44 through 49. Randy, you want to read that then?
Luke 23, 44 through 49. It was now about the sixth hour, and darkness fell over the whole land until the ninth hour. Because the sun was obscured, and the veil of the temple was torn in two. And Jesus, crying out with a loud voice, said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Having said this, he breathed his last. Now when the centurion saw what had happened, he began praising God, saying, certainly this man was innocent. And all the crowds who came together for the spectacle, when he observed what had happened, began to return, beating their breasts. And all the acquaintances and the women who accompanied him from Galilee were standing at a distance, seeing these things.
Okay. It's interesting in verse 47, the latter part, in the American Standard says, certainly this was a righteous man. So you said, certainly this was.
It says, certainly this man was innocent. There's a marginal reference that says, literally righteous.
Ah, okay. All right, and then finally in John, the 18th chapter. I'm sorry, John, the 19th chapter. Start around the 18th verse. Let's see. What'd you say, 28? I guess there's no time in this one, is there? We discussed that, so yeah, let's go ahead with 28 through 30. Carolyn, you want to do that one?
John 19:28-30. After this, Jesus, knowing that all things had already been accomplished, to fulfill the scripture, said, "I am thirsty." A jar full of sour wine was standing there, so they put a sponge full of the sour wine upon a branch of hyssop and brought it up to his mouth. Therefore, when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, "It is finished." And he bowed his head and gave up his spirit.
All right, would you back up and read 25 through 27, please?
Therefore, the soldiers did these things. But standing by the cross of Jesus were his mother and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus then saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." Then he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." From that hour, the disciple took her into his own household.
Okay. All right. So that kind of goes along with the other three readings, except it's just in a different order, I think. So, so there's one thing that I wanted to mention in Matthew 27, and where did it go? Oh. This is not on our questions, I don't think. No. First of all, we discussed in verse 46 why he said, "Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani." And that is, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" And why is that?
He's pointing them to, in particular, Psalm 22, where it contains very specific prophecies of the manner of his death.
Right, exactly. And it starts off with, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" I think we mentioned last week that, yeah, it would be a tough thing to do to try and repeat all the verses of that psalm. And he's probably just barely able to get out this particular phrase to point people to what he was talking about. However, and I didn't look this up for sure, as to what language he was speaking, but I assume that he was speaking Hebrew. So in verse, in the latter half of verse 47, it says, "This man calleth Elijah." Why would they say that? Eli in Hebrew means "my God." Doesn't mean Elijah. So why do they think that it would have been Elijah? Go ahead.
The specific sound of the word sounds like he's saying Eli.
Well, it could, yeah, especially if his voice was weak or something like that. But the other thing that I'm thinking is that since everybody seems to have misunderstood him that way, it's entirely possible that if he was speaking Hebrew, they couldn't understand him very well because they mostly spoke Aramaic. Or he may have been speaking Aramaic, and they were picking it up as Hebrew. I'd have to study that back as to whether Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani is Hebrew or Aramaic. And my version doesn't say which one it is.
Is it
there a difference between Hebrew and Aramaic?
There is.
Okay. I looked it up and it said Aramaic transliterated word Hebrew.
Okay. There are a number of phrases that Jesus says throughout the Gospels that are in Aramaic. But it could have been because of the weakness of his voice that they didn't understand him. But every time I've looked at it, I thought it's because they were speaking two different, as it were, dialects. And perhaps he didn't understand. Of course, he was a Galilean, so that's like somebody from Alabama talking to us, right? So, because what did they say to Peter when he was in the high priest's house or courtyard or whatever?
You can tell by your speech you're Galilean. Translated means you ain't from around here, are you?
That's right. You ain't from around here. You ain't from these parts. Okay. Yeah.
I wonder if they thought, were thinking, you know, they wondered if John the Baptist was Elijah. And, you know, they got it in the back of their heads that could be literally Elijah is going to come. So.
They seem to be fairly well caught up in Elijah as to whether or not he was around or not. And so.
He didn't die, and they all do it. So.
Okay, yeah. As a matter of fact, they searched for him for, what, 3 days? The ones that doubted whether Elisha was telling the truth, that Elijah had been taken up in the chariot. You know, well, maybe God plopped him down in some other hill somewhere. So they went looking around, and they didn't find him. So essentially, he said, what did I tell you? Oh, all right. So it says, what happened at the sixth hour? I mean, I think we've gone through that several times, but what happened? You had a...
I just wanted to make a comment on something that I just read in the commentary that, you know, about a lot of people were saying, oh, here he is, he's woe begone and saying that God has forsaken him, that God has forsaken him. But he said himself in...
John 16:32.
Behold, the hour cometh, the day is come, that ye shall be scattered, every man to his own. This is when he's talking to his disciples. And shall leave me alone. Yet I am not alone, because the Father is with me. So, he was not forsaken.
He's not forsaken.
That was not the only time that he mentioned it. It was also in John 8.
Oh, also in John 8?
Verses 28 and 29.
28 and 29.
Jesus said, when ye have lifted up the Son of Man, then shall ye know that I am he, and I do nothing of myself, but as the Father taught me, I speak these things. And he that sent me is with me. He hath not left me alone, for I do always the things that are pleasing to him.
All right, yeah, two verses that definitely show Jesus' reliance and understanding about the fact that God is with him at all times. So, yeah. So those that would say that, oh, he's saying that God forsook me on the cross. No, he's pointing to Psalms 22. And as you say, he said a couple of times, probably several times, that God is with me always. And I think we can believe that. So when we talk about what happened at the sixth hour, what hour is approximately the sixth hour? Noon. Okay. So just as we reckon things, you know, sort of things starting at at 6 o'clock in the morning. So how long at noon has he now been on the cross?
3 hours.
3 hours, yeah, because it says further on up that that it was the third hour somewhere else. We would find that. But anyway, so he's now been on the cross for 3 hours. And then the next question is, of course, what did Jesus do at the ninth hour?
That's when he cried out with a loud voice and pointed them to the Psalms.
Okay, so that's when he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? A quotation from the first, it's the first verse of Psalms 22. And what was the reaction of the people?
Some thought he was crying out for Elijah.
Right.
Bystanders.
Somebody did what for him?
Tried to give him something to drink.
Right. So put some of the vinegar or the, what is it, sour wine? Sour wine on a sponge and put it on a stick. Now, once again, we discussed this last week. If they put a sponge on a stick, what does that mean?
That
his mouth was too high for them to reach. So, right. And the reaction of the people also was in verse 49. Let's see whether Elijah comes to save him. Jenny?
Just as a side note, I looked up reed and hyssop to see approximately how long that would be, and it's no more than 2 feet.
Okay.
So he's up high, but not really high.
Not in the clouds. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So most of us have got we can reach up to 7 feet, something like that. I don't know. And then with a 2 foot rod, yeah. So, yes, Adam, did you have a comment?
Well, I was gonna ask if a reed is 9 feet.
Say what?
I was gonna ask is a reed 9 feet long?
A reed for measurement could be 9 feet.
I thought I saw it before in the Bible that reed was 9 feet, but I don't have a reference to go check it or anything.
By reed, they mean some sort of.
By that reed, they're talking about like the difference between a cubit and a reed.
They're talking about attaching something to an object. In Ezekiel 40, it talks about a measuring reed in his hand.
Yeah. Right.
Ezekiel 40, verse 3.
Right. So it says, do you have it there, Jenny?
Yes.
Or I have it already, either way.
Yeah. When he brought me there, behold, there was a man whose appearance was like bronze, with a linen cord and a measuring reed in his hand, and he was standing in the gateway.
Okay. And
verse 5,
there it is. Yeah.
Says the length of the measuring reed in the man's hand was 6 long cubits, each being a cubit and handbreadth in length. So he measured the thickness of the wall, 1 reed, and the height 1.
Okay, so that's where the 9 feet would have come from, because it's thought that a cubit was about 1.5 feet. And if it's also a handbreadth, that means that it's a little bit longer than whatever 1.5 feet times 6 is. What's 1.5 feet times 6? 9. Yeah. So it may have been a little over 9 feet. Carolyn?
Mine says a measuring rod. And so a reed and a rod, it's, you know, my mind says, you know, yardstick, perhaps a yardstick of their day. And maybe I don't understand the measurement. Or if they were Haydn's decision, or not so much the way that some errors in history that there was severity.
Yeah.
But it sounds like they, any long object with markings on it, you know, is what a society uses to remember. And so it seems like the crucifixion is, there's a stick. You know, they're using some sort of a stick.
Right. Yeah, they're not trying to measure anything there. So.
Right.
All right. So that's where the idea of reed came from. That's where the idea of reed as a unit of measure came from. So, but this one is just talking about grabbing a stick and putting the sponge on it. So, where is it? In verse 48, took a sponge and filled it with vinegar and put it on a reed and gave him to drink. What in verse 48 does it say in the New American? Matthew 27:48.
Taking a sponge, he filled it with sour wine and put it on the reed and gave him to drink.
And the ESV?
Also says reed,
okay.
But in John 19:29, that's the one that says
it's
a hyssop branch.
Hyssop branch.
And hyssop only grows to max 2 feet.
No longer.
No longer.
24 inches. 24.0 inches, and that's
yes.
It. Oh, okay. So, so this is probably a relatively short stick that they put a sponge on, so they could reach his mouth. And so, right. And it says in verse 48 of Matthew 27, at the end in the American Standard Version says, and gave him to drink. Does it, did it indicate, there didn't indicate any refusal anywhere, does it? Okay, so at the end of verse 48, it says, and gave him to drink. In ESV. I gave it to him to drink, yeah.
Well, if you go into John 19, verse 30, it says when Jesus had received the sour wine, so it sounds like he at least got some of it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. All right. All right. So the next thing then is what happened when Jesus died. Now, we've got actually quite a time span going here. So what happened when he died?
I don't think we finished 25 yet because we haven't talked about everything else that he said just before he died. Because
Oh, yeah.
And then in John, he says, I thirst, and that's when they gave him the sour wine. And then at the end, he said, it is finished. So I found it interesting that when he, like in John, when it says, I thirst, that kind of refers back to Psalm 69, verse 21.
Psalm 69:21. What does that say? I notice also one of the things that he said here in Luke, in verse 43 of chapter 23. Maybe you mentioned this and I didn't pay attention, but he tells the one of the robbers, today shalt thou be with me in paradise. All right, you had
Psalm 69:21. And they gave me also gall for my food, and in my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink.
Oh, okay. So, so they offered him the sour wine mixed with gall at the beginning of the crucifixion. For what purpose?
So he
anesthetic. It's a bit of an anesthetic. So, so it would allow them to enjoy the torture longer. So he refused that. And so then after 6 hours on the cross, he died. But after 6 hours on the cross, what was the condition of the two robbers?
Still living.
They were still alive. And so after, what's his name, went off and petitioned to Pilate to get Jesus' body, he wondered whether he was already dead. And so when he went out to collect Jesus' body, I believe it was at that time that they broke the robbers' legs. So they'd been up there for maybe 10 hours or so, you know, and they weren't yet dead. So, all right. Okay, so Jesus had a number of things that he said up there on the cross as it came between the sixth and the ninth hours. More toward the ninth hour, of course. And then the next one is what happened when Jesus died. So we look at Matthew in chapter 27. What does it say that happened when Jesus died?
The veil of the temple was torn in two.
Okay, and what else?
The earth shook and the rocks were split.
Okay, so there was apparently a fairly good-sized earthquake that happened at that time. And so those three things happened. The veil was ripped, the earthquake happened, and the rocks were rent. Now,
other people were raised from the dead.
Yeah, so let's so look at verse 53. When did they come forth out of the tombs?
After his resurrection,
which was how long after this time?
The third day after. So Friday, Saturday, Sunday, he was raised on the third day.
Okay. I was thinking about the 50 days when he went up to heaven, but I guess so. The resurrection, though, is when he came to life. So, okay, raised from the dead. So, yeah, you're right. So this period here from 52 to 53 is perhaps somewhere in the future. I suppose the tombs could have been opened at that time, and they remained open for the 3 days. But the bodies, the people didn't come out of them until the third day. Until he was raised, until after his death, coming forth after his resurrection. So they entered into, it says, into the holy city and appeared to many. All right, what else happened when Jesus died? What was the impression of the centurion or the people standing around?
That's 47.
Oh, yes. I'm not reading ahead. All right, so what conclusion did the centurion who had been in charge of the crucifixion reach?
Well, in Matthew's account, in verse 54, he said, truly this was the Son of God.
Yeah.
There's a marginal reference that says, or a Son of God, or a Son of God.
Yeah, okay.
There's a good chance the Roman centurion was not a believer.
Indeed. Yeah.
I would comment on 26, the part where in verse 51, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The person stood there and tore it. They would presumably tear it from bottom to top.
I should think so, yeah.
So top to bottom, that seems evidence of a supernatural, miraculous event. And what I'm not sure if I'm going to put it in the right terms, but the veil represented that separation of God from man. And so here we have a tearing of the veil, and that's the end of that Mosaic law system.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yes. And so, yeah. So the veil I think the veil that they're talking about here would be the one between the holy place and the most holy place. I think that's the only veil that's talked about. I mean, the other ones are generally called curtains, or I think that's what they're called.
And the only the, was it the high priest that went in? And so Jesus is now our high priest, and all can approach, you know, the Father with the
right,
with your prayers and so forth.
Right, because the, you know, it shows that the saints are priests.
And the old law.
Right, the end of the old law. I think there was one, I don't remember what it is, I just thought of it, that there's one that says that it's passing away. I don't know whether that's Hebrews. Let me see. See if I can find it. Hebrews 9.
Hebrews 9?
What's it say, Adam?
Well, down at verse 8 it says, the Holy Ghost six things higher than the wind, and the voice that Paul was not yet made manifest. As the first time I was yet standing, and they didn't go their way to the holiest and the closest but. You want me to read the whole chapter?
No, thanks. Let me see if I can find it.
Enters once a year, not without taking blood, which he offers for himself and for the sins of the people committed in ignorance. And then in verse 11, but when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things to come, he entered through the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this creation. And not through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood, he entered the holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. Of course, there's many more details there, but he's the high priest, and it's once for all.
Okay. Yeah. I think it's possible that the phrase that I was looking for is in 1 John, the second chapter, starting in verse 7. It says, "Beloved, no new commandment write I unto you, but an old commandment which ye had from the beginning. The old commandment is the word which ye heard. Again, a new commandment write I unto you, which thing is true in him and in you, because the darkness is passing away, and the true light already shineth." So, 1 John, 2nd chapter, and the passing away part is in verse 8.
I thought maybe you meant 2 Corinthians 3:12.
That sounds more reasonable. 2 Corinthians 3:12. What?
So I don't think it said passing away in the ESV, which is what I just find it. So I switched to ASV and it found passing away.
I don't have that in 2 Corinthians.
So 2 Corinthians 3, 12, and 13.
Oh,
yes, 13. All right. "Having therefore such a hope, we use great boldness of speech and are not as Moses, who put a veil upon his face, the children of Israel should not look steadfastly on the end of that which was passing away." And my search criteria was passing away, and it didn't pick that up. Great.
It's fading away.
Okay.
Fading away?
14.
"But their minds were hardened, for until this very day at the reading of the Old Covenant, the same veil remaineth, it not being revealed to them that it is done away in Christ. But unto this day, whenever whensoever Moses is read, a veil lieth upon their heart. But whensoever it shall turn to the Lord, the veil is taken away. So there's a lot of references to the veil then that we've been talking about also. And the point that Carolyn was making about the fact that we have, a better high priest, and that now with the veil rent from top to bottom, which does appear, since it was several cubits high, I mean, if we go back and look when it was built, it was not a insignificant height. For the veil to be torn from top to bottom, yes, has to be something special. It doesn't do that all by itself. all right. So this is what I was looking at passing away, was the one in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 13. Yeah. So it's good to note what Paul says here. He's making the comparison in spiritual terms of sort of what we're looking at in physical terms here. We see Jesus dying, we see the veil rent from top to bottom, and here in 2 Corinthians we see this is how the spiritual nature of this is. Jesus, who is now our, well, it doesn't say the high priest here, I don't think. It says it in another place. But the fact is here, he's showing that when Moses is read, there's the veil on their hearts. But when people turn to the Lord, then that veil is taken away. And so that's a good comparison there. We haven't diverged at all from the question we were looking at, did we? No, of course not. All right. Conclusion is, centurion who had been in charge of the crucifixion reach, that this was the Son of God. Now, there are alternate readings. This was a Son of God, and this was a Son of a God, and it's just a matter of the, which participle? Particle.
And then the other one is the other.
Particle.
Yeah. The one that said truly this was an innocent or righteous man. So it's.
Right, truly this was a righteous man. Yeah, right.
I don't know how frequently the Romans killed people off, but they seem to be pretty good at it. And for something to stand out to somebody like him, it really must have.
Oh, sure. Yeah. To have the centurion who, being a centurion, he probably has a certain amount of experience and perhaps years in the army, given that he's in charge of 100 soldiers. He's probably seen some of this before, maybe a lot of it before, for all we know. And for him to be surprised or amazed or whatever at the death of Jesus. Yeah, it just stood out to him, and he made this exclamation. So that's interesting.
It had been dark for 3 hours, and they haven't heard him wake, and Jesus can.
There were a lot of unusual circumstances occurring. Yeah, I think that, and also at the dark, where's the dark part? It's verse 45. Now from the sixth hour there was darkness over all the land until the ninth hour. What does the New American say in verse 45 of Matthew 27?
Now from the sixth hour darkness fell upon all the land until the ninth hour.
Okay, there's a footnote in the American Standard Version that says earth. In other words, there was darkness over all the earth until the ninth hour. So that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
Any way you look at it, it's supernatural, but that's even more impressive.
Right. Now, as I mentioned in my lesson on Sunday morning, there's people that want to explain this away. Oh, it was an eclipse of the sun. Total eclipse of the sun. I've yet to see a total eclipse that lasts for 3 hours. I mean, I've seen total eclipses, but they didn't last any 3 hours. I mean, totality of the eclipse lasts maybe, what, 15 minutes at the most? And by that time, you're still seeing, you know, a bloom on either side.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So this is definitely a supernatural occurrence. And so, yeah, that's a good point there, too. That, yeah. But, you know, people, once again, trying to explain away miracles using scientific evidence. I don't think anybody using scientific evidence went back and was able to find that there was a total solar eclipse at this particular time.
Yeah.
So.
Also, it seems like it must have stood out because they didn't do this at, you know, 5 in the morning or 8 at night when you've got, you know, dawn and dusk. And so this is the brightest part of the day.
Yes.
And you couldn't miss it.
No. Right. Yeah. Darkness for 3 hours. A lot of candles around out there, I guess. So, all right. All right, let's just go on to the next section here. So in Matthew, for example, 27:57 through 66. Randy, do you want to read that? 57 through 66?
Matthew 27:57 through 66. When it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who himself had also become a disciple of Jesus. This man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus, and Pilate ordered it to be given to him. And Joseph took the body and wrapped it in clean linen cloth and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had hewn out of the inner rock. And he rolled a large stone against the entrance of the tomb and went away. And Mary Magdalene was there, and the other Mary, sitting opposite the grave. Now on the next day, the day after the preparation, the chief priests and Pharisees gathered together with Pilate and said, "Sir, we remember that when he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days I am to rise again.' Therefore give orders for the grave to be made more secure, or to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise his disciples may come and steal him away and say to the people, 'He has risen from the dead,' and the last deception will be worse than the first." Pilate said to them, "You have a guard. Go, make it as secure as you know how." And they went and made the grave secure, and along with the guard they set a seal on the stone.
Okay. And I'm thinking that he sent this guard of Roman soldiers with them to find out if, to make sure that the deceiver wasn't stolen away. I would have think they would have done something to ensure themselves that his body was still there. We have, that would be pure speculation on my part though, but I would think that indeed they might have done something. Since they had a whole contingent of soldiers, there were probably enough people there to at least move the stone a little bit to peek inside and verify that he was there. But we do know that it says that the stone was rolled over there and a seal was put upon it. So they would know, in fact, whether the stone had been moved after that. And also, in addition to the seal, what was there?
Guards.
Right. And these would have been Roman. These are not temple guards. These are Roman guards that are there. Later on, when we find out that they're concerned that the body was stolen away by his disciples, the Jews told the Roman guards that they would talk to Pilate about that so that they wouldn't come to any harm. And I'm trying to remember now who it was. But when Herod examined some guards, and he caused them to be put to death. I'm trying to remember. Was that?
It was when Peter escaped.
Oh, Peter escaped from the prison, right. Yeah, on his own power. I mean, he managed to pick the locks and, you know, overpower the guards and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, when they found Peter and the other disciples, wasn't it? No. Found Peter had escaped. Herod ordered the guards to be examined, I believe, by scourging, and then had them killed. So, would you like to ring it some more? Okay. So, leave us next week. Take up with question 28. And let me see. So those are the last three questions of lesson 25. Yes?
I know we already finished, but that passage is in Acts 12.
Acts 12?
18 and 19.
18 and 19. So that's where he says that he caused the guards to be put to death.
Yeah, when day came, there was no small disturbance among the soldiers as to what could have been done.
Yeah. It seems like that Herod was not adverse to doing things like that.
Yeah.
I believe if we read through Herod's, you know, family life, that we'll find out that he did a lot of family killing too.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's the one. They all did, I think. So.
With the dysfunction.
Yes, he definitely has a dysfunction. All right, we'll start with question 28 next time. And if we manage to breeze right through all three questions, we'll get into lesson 26 then, for which there are, if you don't have the questions, they're on the back table. Thank you.